Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 26 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thank you very much for downloading it and for continuing to do so. We keep troubling them charts on iTunes and on Acast and everywhere else. So thank you very much for everyone that supports, and specifically those who subscribe and have it set to auto-download, because as I've said before, that's a really good way to support the podcast and kind of jump us up the charts at the start, because it means a load all get downloaded at once. So thank you very much for that. This week's guest is Rue Reynolds. You'll see why that's funny after the conversation and his explanation of a Rue like moo, not Rao like cow. But yeah, of Enter Shikari. Before we do that, I need to quickly ask you for a bit of support to head to my labels a website. If you like the podcast, we do these free every month. In fact, this month, me and poor old Wargie have been churning out two a week, which is crazy. So if you want to support that, head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and just have a look around the web store. We've got a lot of stuff there. We've got mugs, obviously CDs and T-shirts. We've just launched a barbecue apron. A barbecue apron that uses the lyric from my song introduction, "You see a mousetrap, I see free cheese and a fucking challenge." So go there and check that stuff out. It's very much appreciated. The other thing I want to mention quickly before we get into this, I'm just after a lot of support this week. It's Wednesday. It's Wednesday the 25th. And tomorrow, if you're listening to this on March 25th, Wednesday, tomorrow I have my film club at the PCC, the Prince Charles Cinema, in just off Leicester Square in London. And basically, I've been doing my film club for a while now. It's a dream come true. They basically let me pick some films to put on, and then everyone comes and we watch them in the cinema. So we get to see a lot of my favourite films that I've never seen on the big screen. And there's a few reasons for this. I'm a massive film nerd, but even with that, if I put a DVD on at home, or a Blu-ray or whatever, or streaming or whatever it is, you know, I'll be looking at my phone every now and then. I'll be looking around my flat or my house and seeing how it needs to be decorated and how my life's a general mess. Whereas in the cinema, I'm completely lost in that moment and in the experience. So that's really cool. And the other thing we do is we do a Q&A afterwards. It's normally me and a great comedian and film nerd called Rich Sandlin. We do a Q&A afterwards, despite having fuck all to do with the films. But the point of that, again, is since the dawn of the term spoiler alert, you see a film and it's really hard to talk about it because people don't want it spoiled. And our theory is that you're sitting in a room with, you know, 50 to 100 other people who've just seen this film. It's the perfect time to discuss what you think about it. So come along to that. This week it is Unprofit, which I've just butchered with my French pronunciation. But yeah, absolutely amazing film. I love it. I can't wait to see what you people think of it. We're also going to be screening a little video of a thing I did. I reenacted a scene from Unprofit at Rich Sandlin's film club. So, yeah, you'll get to see that at the end. But come along. It's going to be good fun. Details are online and at the Prince Charles Cinema website. Also, Birmingham and London. My We Are Lizards Club night is this weekend as well. So on Friday in Birmingham, if you're about and you fancy hearing a great band called Tiny Giant, who are just blowing me away, so even if you can't make it, go and check them out. And then I'll be DJing. I'll have DJ Destruction here. I've mentioned numerous times on the podcast, with Yoda on, with Zane Lowe on. Everyone kind of knows he's the best kept secret in DJing. So we will be at the Hare and Hound on Friday. Come on down. You can buy tickets in advance, or you can just turn up on the night and come and check us out. And then my We Are Lizards Club night. Also, we have traditionally done it at the book club in Shoreditch, and that's still our home. We've had 3 years of sold out events there, but we're trying to try a few other places out as well, not instead. So we've got it at the Stillery in Camden, which is a lovely venue. We've done one there so far. I really liked it. It's got that kind of gritty, dirty venue vibe, but the sound's really good, the setup's really good, the drink isn't that expensive, which again is a big problem in a lot of London clubs and nights. So come down to that. We are at the Stillery on Saturday. That's about all my plug-in. That's cheeky, isn't it? Anyway, this week's guest from Enter Shikari, and it was great to sit down and have a chat about Shikari, about all the independent music side of it. They've been inspirational on how they've released a lot of stuff and things like that. They've really been creative with their, not only with their sound, but with their approaches. So without further ado, this is episode 27. And that's it. We've started. We're recording.
Cool.
How you doing, man? I'm joined by Rao. Is it Rao or Roo? I never know how to say your name.
It is. Well, it is Rao.
Rao.
Because it's short for Rowton, which is a village in Norfolk.
Wow.
Where my granddad was born. Rock
that's,
and roll.
That's awesome. That's a good name.
Everyone just says Roo as well.
It occurred to me because, I mean, it's not like we know each other really well. But we've talked a fair bit, but I've realised it's always been over email or Twitter or Facebook. As I was preparing to do this podcast, I'm like, I don't know if I've ever said your name out loud in front of you, so I don't know if I've got it right or not. But so Rao, and we'll try and correct all these people who say Roo completely inappropriately.
I used to say this stupid little just rhyme. It's Rao like cow.
Yeah. Straightforward.
Not Roo like moo. But the other day, I saw this, just like some kid was doing a review of the latest album on YouTube, and he was like, it was American dude. He was like, it's quite funny because it's actually pronounced Roo like moo, not Rao like cow. So he completely switched it.
Completely switched it the wrong way.
How did that happen?
You've made it memorable and he's completely turned it on its head. I love that. I've got a whole list of things we want to get through. Obviously, there's going to be a music stuff. I want to talk some politics with you. I want to talk about the new record, about touring. But on the way here, I was about 10-15 minutes away. That's far enough to not give away the location of your secret back cave. But you're about 10-15 minutes away from South Mim Services, and I want to talk as someone who's toured for a while. I want to talk a bit about service stations because they've become
a key classic.
Have you got a favourite? That's it. I've always rated South Mims. I'm crackling a bit. I think that's me. Yeah, I've always rated South Mims. Have you got a preferred services? Because as silly and jokey as it sounds, it genuinely becomes a thing, man.
Yeah.
Like when you're touring, you genuinely have your favourite services, and you know you need a certain amount from services. What's your
Well, they start
highlights?
To feel quite homely.
Yeah.
There's
completely.
Watford Gap, is that the one just at the start of the M1?
Yeah, that's solid.
That always makes me think we're close to home.
Yep, you get
it.
Or
we're just starting out, you know, so it's quite an emotional place.
Yep. I mean, I've always been have you gone to Westmoreland Services?
Don't know.
They're a bit legendary because they're on the way into Scotland. It's the first one. I don't know if it's just before you get into Scotland or out. And it's the one that's like run by a farm. So it's all fresh farm produce. So it's not like there's no McDonald's or anything there. It's all fresh farm food. So that's generally, you know, listed as the top one. I'm nerding out over services and you're looking a bit confused and blank. But I feel, if anything, I'm teaching you for future.
Yeah.
For future. I was thinking this on the way. I think it's Gloucester Services have just opened one similar that is run by farm. Like so, it's a farm services, and there's even a shop to buy like fresh eggs and stuff like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's pretty rad.
There's loads of them, and when we're touring America, like they're usually just complete carbon copies of each other. Like you say with McDonald's, Starbucks, and it's just an onslaught. And then you do get one like that where it's just a farm. It's just like little place, an old couple selling. Yeah,
and it means something. But then at times you need a Cobham services, because Cobham is key to me, because that's been added onto the M25 services, and it's got a Papa John's, it's got a Greg's in a services, and a Papa John's. It's got a KFC. I like it. But I'm going to continue off of the the services talk for now. You're kind of in the middle of touring and break from touring. How's it all been going? I'm then going to go back to the start. But yeah, how's that all been?
Yeah, great. Well, I mean, most of last year was making the new album.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, we still did a few festivals and a few little tours, but it was kind of nice to just spend a, you know, decent time at home. And then everything kicked off again in January. And we've done a fair bit of Europe, just finished our UK tour.
Yeah.
And now we got this week off, and then we head to the US.
Amazing.
The seven weeker, as we call it.
The long runs in US. Was it last year you did a walk tour, or was it the year before?
Yes, yeah.
How was that? Because I always think, I wanted to do it. It's always been a name because of growing up listening to a lot of punk and hardcore and things like that. It was always a thing. I talk to a lot of people who've done it and they say it's absolutely an absolute nightmare. It kills you. It's horrible. But still, there's still, even though everyone who's told me that, I'm like, I still want to do it at some point. So, you know, I don't care. How was it for you guys? Because you posted some pictures of some amazing looking crowds and some real rowdy moments, it seemed.
I don't know where to, it's a bit of a love-hate thing, I guess.
Everyone seems to have that, specifically the walk tour.
The community is brilliant. You meet, you become, you know, best friends with bands because you're just hanging out every day.
Constantly.
And the crowds are really good.
Yeah.
But it really is a slog. There's no sort of, if you compare it to European festivals, it couldn't be further from that. There's no backstage.
Right.
There's no dressing room or anything like that. So you have your bus. And of course, a lot of it's in the middle of summer and a lot of it's going through Arizona and Texas and your aircon breaks down all the time. So most of the day you're just sweating like a pig and you're just, the site's extremely big as well. I mean, you get catering and the catering is amazing.
Yeah.
It's really good. And they do all sorts of vegan stuff and everything. So they really cater for everyone.
Yeah.
But everything's quite a walk as well. And there's no buggies from your bus to backstage and all that kind of thing.
I mean, that's the thing with America in general. And as you'll know, and as you're about to engage upon, and not to make it all seem depressing, is it is so much bigger and that big. Yeah. And again, the thing a lot of people don't realise on a lot of US tours, and from what I've heard of the Warped Tour, is half the time it's not a hotel's affair. This is, you're in your van or in your bus.
Mm.
It literally takes as long to get there as you've got, if you know what I mean. So you're literally off stage in a bus until you're on stage again, essentially. So, yeah.
It was weird. Like the very first tour we did in America was after about 4 years of, like, proper touring Europe.
Yeah.
And the first tour we did there, we were playing sort of like 200 cap places, but we did it on a double decker tour bus.
Wow.
So it's utterly stupid. We're just throwing money away.
Yeah.
But since then we've realized, we just have to go back to your roots. You just have to think about how we did the UK, you know, up and down for 2 years in our little Royal Mail van.
Yeah.
You know, mouldy seats and sleepless nights and that kind of thing.
It's definitely the way, I think. I don't know. Yeah, it's a weird thing. I'm at the point now where I'd love to try America in a bus, because the only times I've done it has been in a van, or even we did it a load in a large rental car. And that was it, just to keep the budgets down and not throw too much money away. I mean, we've jumped all the way ahead to America. What was your kind of musical upbringings and roots? What kind of scene was it? Was it Hertfordshire? Hertford that you grew up in? What was going on there and what were your influences?
Well, I guess my first sort of music was probably Motown and Northern Soul, as my dad used to be a DJ and he had huge just boxes and boxes, crates and crates of records. And I can remember earliest memories of, we used to live in Scotland and we had this house with this huge, really scary basement. It used to frighten the life out of me, but I'd still go down there just to use his decks.
That's
and
wicked.
Play records, and it would sort of brighten this whole gloomy basement up, you know, listening to like Motown. It's like the happiest music.
That's
there
amazing.
Is. So I think that definitely instilled a real love for melody.
Yeah.
It's like I've been in sort of like straight up hardcore bands before, but I feel like there has to be a sense of melody for me to sort of really be emotionally connected to a track, I suppose.
I mean, that's awesome. I had Wes Borland on a while ago, and he was saying how he got into Motown and stuff like that late and kind of had to relearn, because everything he'd learned was rock and this is this. And then it was like, oh, hang on, there's actually, I've learned to play instruments amazingly well, but I've not learnt about songwriting as such, and melody and structure and things like that. So it's kind of, it's good that you got that early on. And do you think that, because again, I'd say every Shikari record I've heard, a Motown hasn't jumped out at me. Which you think that's kind of under there and in your original, in the structures you build and the melodies and things like that. Do you think that sits in there somewhere?
I think it must do. I mean, yeah, I think the sort of the passion and the aggression is the thing that it stands out with Shikari. But just because like Motown Northern Soul has been one of the genres that stuck with me.
Yeah.
Like, I still listen to it now. So I think, you know, it must sort of seep in unconsciously.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. So where did it go from there? From listening to Motown in a scary basement in Scotland?
Yeah.
What was the next step?
It would have been, well, the first instrument I picked up was the trumpet when I was about 10, I think. Kind of enjoyed that for a few years. And then when I sort of started, you know, getting into my teens, it's like, trumpet wasn't cool, you know. All my mates were playing guitar, so I
got
rocking
a bit of trumpet recently, right?
I'm well back into it now.
You're back into it, yeah.
Love the trumpet. Yeah. But I suppose got into our local scene quite early, and we were really lucky. We had really thriving, just like small scene where even like UK touring bands would stop off. Not big bands, but you know, small bands. And we had a little youth club called The Pioneer, which is still going now, which is crazy considering the amount of times the council has threatened and tried to push through plans to shut it down and build flats.
That's awesome, man.
Offices. But yeah, I guess like hardcore punk was huge influence. Ska as well. That's probably one of the first sort of, I never know what label to use, but I guess socially conscious bands.
Yeah.
Like Adequate Seven and Cap Down were two massive influences on us.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's about, when we're about 16 that we probably started Shikari, or 17.
I was going to say, so, because I always remember when I first started hearing about Shikari, it always came with the attachment of, it's these real young kids that are just, are building this hype and doing this thing. So what, I don't know, how did you kind of have that, the mindset or wherewithal to kind of jump instantly from the often, again, generally with younger bands, you have that, I don't know, a local band mentality. You're either emulating someone or things like that. How did you kind of bypass that, essentially, and seem to just jump to your own sound and your own thing?
Well, we had... It was hard to sort of break in and get a show at that youth club unless you put it on yourself. So we used to do that a bit. But the one sort of big thing the whole scene used to unite for, which it will seem like a bit of a contradiction, was a battle of the bands.
Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah, perfect.
So even though there was a real sense of unity in the scene, because we often had to fight our council just to...
I'm going to pause you for a second because I'm getting tons of crackling. I'm not sure if it's that lead. I don't know if I've done something there. Yeah. Yep. That should be better. No, that's fine. I think it just wasn't improperly. That's my fault. So continue. Battle of the bands.
Yeah, battle of the bands. And yeah, so
it's weird how them things can bring everyone together, because it's the same. I see that with spoken word nights. I think it's and it's a weird thing. This is going to sound harsh now, but it's true. Everyone is out for themselves. So if you're doing a spoken word night, if you put an open mic on, you're going to get a lot more people in the crowd, because there's a lot more people who want to get up there and do their thing than want to just go and watch and support local things. So a battle of the bands is a great one, because there'll be a lot of bands and their friends will come along to be involved, whereas if they weren't playing, they probably wouldn't be there. But again, that's logical and natural. So that kind of...
Well, that sense of competitiveness, I think, was... It was there. It was underlying sort of the whole scene. And
that's cool.
I think we certainly didn't care about like winning or anything like that, but we wanted to sort of make our mark, sort of thing. And I think as well, because the music we were starting to this is honestly probably before Enter Shikari. This is when we were called Hybrid.
Hybrid.
Two Y's.
Yeah. Two Y's. Impressive.
I mean, it was fairly melodic, but I don't think it was ever going to sort of win. I think it was always the local sort of like pop punk and ska punk bands that used to go away with it.
The won everyone over.
Yeah. But I think it definitely, yeah, it instilled that sense of we wanted to stand out, we wanted to do something different, and we just then became a bit more aggressive, a bit more into the punk side of things and the hardcore side of things, as well as moving into technology, like digital stuff. So I got like a chaos pad and various sequences, and yeah, just wanting to get out of the local scene as well, because you could only play that one place.
Yeah.
And I think to get gigs elsewhere, you really have to push yourself. And
yeah, I mean, getting on the electronic side of things early in that kind of genre and setup is something that made you stand out hugely, because at that point, again, particularly on more local scenes, it's guitars, drums, bass, and a singer. So as soon as you add something, it may lose you the battle of the bands, but it will potentially win you the battle actually to move outside of your local scene and local area and actually stand out and do something a bit more engaging. For me, I didn't play anywhere locally for years until I'd played pretty much everywhere in the UK because of that discomfort of not wanting to just, I don't know, play to my mates, or maybe a nerves of playing to my mates. It was that thing of wanting to go out where no one has any preconceived ideas, therefore you can kind of do what you want and not have that, you know, that fear that people are going to be like, that's not really you, or that's not your thing, or whatever. So yeah. So at what point did you get to start getting out there and touring again? You're all quite young when it started to take off on more of a national level.
Well, we used to just try and get as many gigs as we could weekends, and mainly to start off with, that would be gig swaps.
Yeah.
So we'd promote a show in St Albans, maybe try and get one somewhere else, even just Watford, down the road, but still to makes a band difference. Up north, that's two gigs. Yeah. It will be a different crowd. We used to make friends with bands from Scotland, from Wales, and just try and get gigs anywhere. And it would never be playing the big cities. It would be playing these, you know, rundown youth clubs and little, you know, the toilet circuit, as it's called.
Yeah.
And that seemed to just fare us really well. A lot of the times we'd play and it would literally be to the sound guy, and perhaps his girlfriend or his dog, and that would be it.
If you could win them over, though, man, it's no joke, because genuinely they're the ones who see everything come and go. So if you make an impact on them, it can be a good gauge of what you're doing. And
yeah, absolutely. And
how you're doing it.
Every time we seem to go back somewhere, there'd just be a few extra people, and it was just word of mouth and having that online hub when, you know, the MySpace back in the day, that sort of served us well as well.
It's great to, I think the key for all the bands, I think, that came up around that time that are still here now are the ones that did exactly that, were putting in the work in the real world, still had that online thing to say, here's where you can find out more, here's where you can spend money on us and all that kind of thing if necessary, but didn't only rely on that. I think when the MySpace boom started, a lot of musicians were like, I'm getting tons of followers, but not actually getting out there and playing in front of people and not putting in that time. And that's the ones who were huge for a minute, and now their MySpace page is still there as like the painting of Dorian Gray or whatever it is. It's just in the loft, just getting older and older, and that's their kind of their MySpace is sat there doing that. You also seem to come up and get embraced a lot around the time that all ages festivals and shows and stuff like that were going on. Did you do a lot of them, or am I remembering you doing like one and then that sticking in my head as being a real turning point?
I'm pretty sure we did. I mean, especially at 17, because a lot of venues wouldn't let us play. I can remember doing, like, there was that one at the Underworld, Subverse or something back in the day. There's a few others, and as well, that felt like you were getting into a scene as well, and like-minded people, whereas before that, we'd played the most sort of seedy stuff, like pay-to-play shows. You know, you'd just be playing this. There's one in Leicester Square,
it's pretty disgraceful, isn't it? The whole pay-to-play thing. I mean, let's discuss the darkness of that for a thing. It's essentially a promoter saying, my one job is to promote. I can't be asked to do that, so to cover that, you have to pay to come and... Yeah. And so many people fall for it. And so many people, particularly from out of London, I find. And I was the same with a lot of my local bands. A local band would get a gig in London and they'd get a coach and we'd all go there and go and watch them and support them. And it's like, this is so fucking pointless because all of you that are watching them, you could have all been watching them at your local around the corner. It's not actually, you have that illusion of London. And I think for a long while, promoters exploited that and kind of said, you get to come and play in Leicester Square or in Camden Town and stuff like that, but you've got to pay. That's crazy, right? You're paying to work, essentially saying, is it all right if I come and work for you? I'll pay you to let me work for you. That's it's horrible.
Very, very strange. And we fell for it, you know, head first.
It happens.
We did, we used to do, like you say, get a minibus.
Yeah.
And my dad would drive down a load of our mates. And I can remember saving up as well. We all did like paper rounds and stuff like that, little odd jobs, and, you know, save up to hire the van to lug a load of our mates there. And, you know, we all had fun, but like we didn't get anything out of it.
No, there's no benefit because you're not playing to this mythical London crowd. You're playing to your local crowd.
Yeah. And that promoter's not
after
the sort
a coach
of,
journey.
Yeah. And that the type of promoter that does that is one that isn't connected at all. And he can't then, you know, go to his other promoter mates and go, oh yeah, they had loads of people, it was great, you should check out this band.
Yeah.
It was just, he walked home with a bit of money in
his
pocket.
It's a one-off thing. And I this is going to sound, you know, I feel I should give some a disclosure. Obviously, I run a club night and the Camden version of it has live. We've never done pay to play, but we do look at bands and go, how many people can they bring in? Mm. You know, that's a valid thing of bands doing that, but it's that paying to get to do that is crazy.
It's finding the right bill as well, isn't it? And the right sort of group of bands that are, you know, that the fans of one band are going to enjoy the rest.
Exactly. And so your coach load of people are going to learn about a new band that have bought their coach load. And then it works. Then it's logical. But a lot of them, particularly in those days, I remember there was a band I used to love locally called White Girl. And they were kind of a bit of a bluesy rock type thing, but they were really good. But I saw them on lineups with metal bands, with, you know, indie, with all sorts. It's like no one who came to see that metal band is going to be into the band I've come to see, and vice versa. So,
yeah, that happened to us so much as well. Just we'd be playing with folk bands.
Yeah.
Literally getting booed off stage and people just sticking their finger up at us.
So how was that early on? Because one of the things that you really got a lot of hype for was the energy and excitement of your live shows.
Mm.
How was that when you're having to put that energy and excitement in front of a crowd that are there to see a folk band or in a half empty room? I mean, it's easy, and I'm not saying that this American tour isn't going to be hard on your recent tours and bars, but as soon as you start to get a fan base, it's so much easier to go out there and give 100%. And I think you learn a lot from going out and having to give 100% when there's two people in the room and still having to go out and not be shaken and not be like, all right, let's make a joke of this or take the piss. Like going, no, this is a performance.
Yeah.
Do you think that helped you in those early days of having to get grounded in that?
Yeah. It teaches you so much. I mean, we got to a very strange period where I think we were starting to think, well, this isn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, uni was sort of beckoning and our parents were like, yeah, you need to go to uni.
Get a proper job.
And there were shows where we'd be playing to just, you know, a few, maybe like 10 people. And it, you know, it would be like a bill that we shouldn't have been on at all. Whether it's bands that are way heavier than us, like a death metal bill where everyone's going to hate us, you know.
Yeah.
Genre purists aren't going to like us, and metal
fans. As soon as you've got
be.
Electronics, it can confuse a lot of people.
Yeah, and that confusion quickly turns to anger. Yeah. We found, but so we got to the stage where some shows would be literally walking out on stage trying to provoke like a reaction of anger.
Completely.
I remember a show we did at, I think it was upstairs at the Garage. Just running over tables, kicking people's drinks over. Really immature, stupid stuff, but that's what it came to. There was this, I think there was an element of frustration, an element of like knowing there was this scene there and there was this crowd there for, that would understand what we were doing, but no one...
You can't get them to hear you.
We couldn't access it. Yeah. And
that's great, though, because that kind of thing is still going to build hype and build legend and things like that. I always remember hearing about a Dan Sartain gig where... And I really enjoyed his music, but I think the thing that made me hear of him was he was at a gig that was going particularly horrible in America, and someone was being really abusive, and he broke a nose with the butt of his guitar, like a mid song, just smashed him in the face and continued on. I think the gig had to end, but it was like, wow, I want to know what this guy is about, because as silly as it is, if you're doing it out of genuine passion or emotion. Whether you agree with it as an action or not, you know that they fucking believe in what they're doing. And that's important in music, I think. That passion is real. So if you're running around on tables and kicking drinks over because it's all too much, that gets it across. It means you're taking it... You believe in what you're doing. Yeah. If you're willing to piss off a whole room full of people, you believe in what you're doing, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it made us just, you know, doing that. It was literally like 6 months of that.
Yeah.
And when people started to understand it, we started playing to the right crowds, it just gave us a whole new sort of satisfaction and just happiness and gratitude for the people that were there and did get it.
Do you find it removed all nerves? I mean, do you get nervous before gigs?
That 6 months certainly did. Because that's it. I just didn't care.
I've always felt I've played some amazingly big crowds, and beforehand I'm playing some Scrabble on my phone or something, and not particularly nervous, but it's because of that early days of playing on street corners or whatever. That as soon as there's a crowd that, number one, are there for a gig, that's nice, and number two, are there specifically to see you, it's like, you're not nervous because that's the bit that you're excited about. That's exciting to get to do. So I'd imagine that those 6 months quite quickly meant that as soon as you did start to explode, it was like, cool, man. It couldn't get too big, if you know what I mean. There's nothing that can faze you.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And playing those types of shows as well, and I think it gives you like a... You can then connect more to the people that do get it, and you can have that. I mean, the best thing about live music is that emotional connection. The fact that everyone's so vulnerable to music, and you know that they're feeling probably quite a similar feeling to you when you wrote it or when you're playing.
Yeah, completely.
And it just gives you a whole new gratitude, and you can sort of perceive that more.
The gratitude, it stops you from getting complacent at any point, really, because you've had those horrible gigs, so you're always appreciative of when they're going well.
Yeah.
So what do you think was the turning point? Because obviously, I mean, jumping forward a bit, famously, you guys were the second, and possibly the second only ever unsigned band to sell out the Astoria, was something that, you know, was a big deal at the time. How quick was that turnaround, and what do you think? Do you think you just got in front of that right crowd, or have you got anything specific that you can say, oh, this is what made them get it and made it switch?
Well, for us, it felt really slow. It was just that slow climb of going back to those little, you know, villages and towns, crazy, just playing again and again.
Because the disadvantage of coming through at any reasonably young age is people assume you've not put in the legwork and grafted, which if you started at 16, if you all break at 17 or 18, and people will be like, oh, you know, overnight success. It's like, if that's overnight, that was a long fucking night, man, because that's been grafting all around the country. So, but it felt like that. It was that slow build and the work in there that... So do you still feel it was a gradual thing when it exploded, or was it a slow build and then all of a sudden, holy shit, look, we've got a huge following?
I think at the moment when the press actually started, you know, we're getting our first few pages in Kerrang and online, and people started blogging about us and stuff, I think then there was quite a big jump.
A big jump, yeah.
And I remember the first time we played Download, 2006, I think. And that did feel like a wow moment.
Awesome.
Just walking out on that stage, and it was like all the little places we played to, you know, sort of around the Midlands and the North, all those people would come, and it felt like just a really unifying
moment. And it feels like a lot for them as well to see that moment. Yeah. If someone has seen you in a room with 10 people, to then get to see you on a big stage in this big moment, it means that more. Download and Kerrang are the two things I think I'm most jealous of you for, because I used to have a subscription to Kerrang. Always love Kerrang. They've never, because my stuff's more hip hoppy, they've never really covered us, but I've always had a secret. And you've won like a shed load of Kerrang awards, haven't you? Yeah. I always remember you kind of getting a lot there. And Download, when I was doing the solo album tour, we were doing like at Reading and Leeds, we had the biggest circle pit I've ever seen. And we had, you know, on that year of touring, I broke my ribs 3 times, I think, at gigs. You know,
Jesus.
The gigs were rowdy as fuck.
Right.
And the Download was one that I was like, I want to get to play there, because I know they don't think a weird fit, but I think our current tour and show was, again, because it's that growing up only going to punk gigs and hardcore gigs kind of thing, it was like, I think we can not show them a thing or two, but, you know, we can hold our own in that crowd.
Yeah.
And then... And it never happened. And it was like, man. So how was that to get to a Download type thing, particularly as coming from playing as the kids with electronic stuff on metal lineups and things like that at points, like when you're up and coming, how was that to get there and go, yeah, we're legit. We're as going to get the crowd as rowdy as anyone this weekend.
Well, I remember actually being pretty terrified, because I can remember we were trawling the Download message boards, the forums online back in the day. And oh man, there were obviously the forums are populated by the sort of diehard metal kids who've been going to Download forever, who hated us.
Yeah.
Like, there's genuine hatred. And so we were quite scared, but none of that formulated in the actual reality of the show. Like, everyone there was loving it. And it really was just one of their moments. It was like, I can't remember anything. It's just a blur.
Yeah.
And there actually aren't very many YouTube videos on it. I guess it was before everyone had camera phones.
It's definitely, I don't think we can underrate how nerve-wracking that must have been, because it was right at the start of the time that your heavier stuff would even consider electronics as being in that metal area, in the metal or hardcore area. If it had electronics, it was somewhere else, you know, completely shunned. So... yeah, that was a big deal.
it felt like it as well, because there was really, I'm just trying to think of, there were like two other bands. I remember there was one sort of quite localish band called Flip Cycle who had a bit of electronics in, and then there was another one, that drum and bass band. I think we used to play with them in like Amersham and Chesham and places like that. But that was literally the only bands that we'd come across who were sort of loosely in our scene that we're using that kind of stuff. So it really did feel like quite scary.
But
I think we genuinely all loved so many different types of music. Like Rory, our guitarist, his older brother was a drum and bass DJ. So every time going to his house, you know, from 15, 16, just being pummeled with drum and bass, like that absorbed that. And we used to love that. And obviously living near London, got to watch dubstep grow from its very, very early.
Yeah.
So I think we always just got bored very quickly, and just wanted, even though it was scary as hell, like we were just, a lot of it was just writing for ourselves. It was quite a selfish thing. And like, we don't want to just play, you know, blast beat, breakdown, singy chorus and repeat, you know.
Yeah.
We wanted to have all sorts of flavours in there. And yeah, so the fidgetiness and the boredom kind of overcame the fear.
Yeah. it's good to have enough stuff there to distract you from the fear of not knowing where to go with that. So again, another thing, I've gone on Wikipedia and stuff like that. And by the way, you've got an amazing Wikipedia page.
Oh, yeah.
It's broken down. It's in depth. I didn't even have time to read all of it. But I also wanted to go off a lot of things I just... I remember, because we were doing our thing and touring about around the same time that you guys were coming up, or at least we were out there at that point already. And I always remember hearing about, again, I'm sure it was the Astoria gig. I remember hearing something about you guys spending all your money on a laser, essentially. Yeah. What was the deal? I can't remember exactly. I just remember it's been, they've spent like all the everything on a big laser for this gig. So they've just got this massive, like, that's too big for the venue, that's going to kill everyone inside. What was the deal there? Can you explain that a bit?
Basically, the thought of actually getting paid like an all right sum, I think we were just so excited, and we were literally like kids in a sweet shop when our my dad at the time was our sort of only, well, not even a manager then, just helping us out, and he kind of presented us with these possibilities, and it's like, you're getting this amount, and you know, I've done a bit of research, look, you can get this lighting module and this lighting guy to control it for this amount. And we were like, oh my God, we can actually have production, we can actually have a show, we can really fuse the visual with the audio, like, and that was so exciting. And,
it's a huge thing to realize, right?
It was extremely surreal. And what made it even more surreal is the thing we ended up going for was Coldplay were doing something, and it was a day off, and somehow we managed to get one of their lasers from like, literally their stadium shows.
Yes.
So
that's what I remember hearing. It was like a stadium laser in the Astoria that was, you know, it was a decent size venue, but
we were
certainly wasn't
a
stadium.
So excited. Yeah.
It was brilliant. That?
Yeah, it was great. There was actually...
Tell me you literally pressed the laser once at the end and it just made everyone go mental. The rest of the gig is like building up to, now we're going to press it, and then everyone died.
Well, I mean, if you think before that, all we used to have was we'd have like a four-way plug adapter.
Yeah.
One with like, they had a switch on it for all four plugs. Yeah. And then we'd literally have four strobes, just little ones that you can get from like Argos or something, plugged into that. And then either Rory or Chris onto their pedal board would have that, and they'd just flick the switch with their toe, literally, every now and then. So that was our light show. So the thought
that's dope in itself, though. That's a creative idea there of having that control of and not having to have a lighting guy, which costs money, you know?
Yeah, so every time Rory would be stomping on the sort of distortion pedal for a heavy bit, he'd also click the strobes.
Brilliant.
there's actually a recording... of, I think it was something off our first album, well, because that's the only album we had out then, but I think it was Return to Energizer, which has a real sort of trance section in it, and that's, I think, the first point where the laser came on, and you can hear in the recording the drums completely mess up, because Rob was literally looking behind himself at the laser, just like in absolute awe, and just like just completely fluffing the cymbals, and just
I love it.
Funny.
Just enjoying the gig more than forgetting that he's meant to be playing the gig. Just going, look at this.
Exactly. Yeah,
I love it. So how was that? I mean, it's your debut album. It got in the top 10, right? Was it number like? In the top five or something, it smashed into the charts.
Yeah, I can't remember.
How was that after all that build up? And was that on your own label at that point? Because I know it was independent artists, and you know, when did you kind of start the own label and releasing your own stuff? How did that work?
It just kind of evolved. So we had, I remember again saving up a load of. Paper round money to buy one of them six-way CD burners. Then we just printed them up. I think we used to sneak into my dad's work as well and just like do all the printing of the sort of sticky labels. Brilliant. And stick them onto the CD and just doing everything we can, and just that was to release. We did two EPs like that and started selling them online, and after things got bigger and bigger, it was only then that labels started sort of sniffing around and taking us out for dinner and schmoozing us up.
It's great, isn't
it? But I think luckily at that point we'd met our other manager, Ian, and he kind of guided us, and we sort of came to the realization that even though not at the beginning, it was all out of necessity. We were just doing it by ourselves because we had no other choice. We then, after that, we kind of realised that, there is this scene, there's DIY, there's hardcore, this is actually what people do, and it's you can get by and it can work, and learning about like Discord Records and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just then seemed like the obvious next step to just try and make our own label. Got distribution deals and kept all our copyrights and everything, and it just, it felt
that's
right.
That's perfect. I mean, if you can get a distribution deal or some kind of publishing in there or whatever, it becomes completely doable and manageable if you've got the right head on your shoulders. If you've got the wherewithal to go, right, here's how I'm going to run shit, essentially.
Yeah.
Then that can work great. So how was that to then, how did you find that step up from sneaking into your dad's place to print things off to then having a record that's in the charts and having expectation on further records, having a distribution deal and all these other things? Mm. How was that?
I mean, that's probably the most like surreal year of my life. I think that would have been 2007. Yeah. That was the sort of the first time we went to America as well, and we were getting the support of, like, you know, big bands were like sort of taking us out. Like we did a tour with Billy Talent, Linkin Park. Yeah, I mean, it was just proper surreal. Huge, and then people like Tony Wilson started saying we were the best thing since the Sex Pistols and all these like crazy statements.
Yeah, yeah,
and, proper sort of pinch yourself stuff. So it was just a mental year. And again, it's just a blur now. My memory's not what...
It just all those things though is they... As soon as they become your reality and your day job, essentially, they stop registering as quite as amazing and unusual as they are, if you know what I mean. So it's not that you take it for granted, but it's like, right, this is just what had to happen and this is what has happened.
Yeah.
And it becomes a natural progression, I guess. So how's it been to climb up in venue sizes and the stages at which you're doing at festivals and things like that? Have you adapted your live show to fit the bigger venues? Do you prefer or, you know, hark back to playing the Astoria with a stadium-sized laser? Or, you know, have you kind of adapted that across the kind of size of venues and as you've built the crowds?
We were always quite adamant, like, for instance, that we would never play a main stage festival.
Yeah.
I can remember getting our booking agent and literally putting that as like a stipulation, like, we don't do main stages. Yeah. It's not what we're about. We're about the sweaty, dingy, you know, intimate places.
Yeah.
And it's cool. Like, I mean, for instance, last year we did a tour of like real small out of the way places in the UK. So we can still do that and keep that sort of side of us alive. But there was a point, I think it was Lowlands Festival in
Holland. Great festival in Holland, yeah.
Yeah. I think, maybe 2008 or something. And we were playing a tent and someone pulled out of the main stage and we had got offered this slot. And it was literally the day after. Or no, it was the same day. It was the same day as the show we were playing in the tent.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we just said, look, okay, sort of reluctantly. I mean, looking back, it's just like embarrassing, to, you know, being offered a main stage slot. It's like, be grateful you're reluctant,
completely. Like,
but we did it, and it was just a total slap around the face. It was just like, wow, this is awesome.
This is really good. Yeah.
And now it's like my absolute favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
Not, it doesn't have to be like a big main stage, but just a stage that's outdoors, like with no roof, no tent or anything.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's so raw and primitive about it. Like,
I've got to put a little story and confession in here. I've argued, only because the kid will probably be listening, I've argued with a kid on Twitter about you guys playing a main stage.
Oh, really?
At Red and Lees, because it came about because this... I think I tweeted about your new record, which we will get onto as well. And this kid said, oh, it'd be great if you supported them I think it was when you were doing the Roundhouse recently. And I was saying, that's wicked, but we're not the same size, but of a similar size, you know, we play similar size of venues. And I was kind of saying, generally, you want to take a band that's a lot smaller and give them exposure, if you know what I mean? Like, we always pick our support bands really carefully.
Yeah.
And equally, if you're playing a big venue, you don't necessarily want my fan base taking all a load of the tickets. Do you know what I mean? I was just trying to explain that that's not how it works. And this kid got furious saying, how are you saying that you're as big as them? They've played the main stage at Reading. And I was like, well, I mean, number one, I'm saying that they're playing bigger venues than us. That's fine, you know, but playing the main stage and different stages isn't necessarily... Like, you can play a better slot on a small stage.
Yeah,
you can
play
an opening slot on a main stage. But it ended up this massive argument on Twitter. And I was like, I don't know what's going on here, because I'm not arguing that anyone is bigger or smaller than anyone. I'm just saying that, you know, I'd rather go and watch you guys than come and support, kind of thing, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was an interesting argument and discussion. I thought I had to get in there because that kid's probably listening again. See, I told you they played the main stage. I know that, man. What is it about that open air thing that you enjoy the most? Because there's a lot of that on the Warped Tour as well, isn't there? There's a lot of the open air ones, and somehow there is a difference. I feel you can play to the same amount of people or less people, but if it's the right stage and the right setting, almost it can just be that bit more, feel that bit bigger, and more dramatic.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the tents, if you take away the festival vibe and, you know, the fact that everyone's covered in mud and having great time and off their face, so if you take that away, it can often just feel like you're playing a venue, you know.
There's just something
quite, I don't want to get sort of spiritual about it, but like there's just something about playing outdoors, like just the fresh air, seeing the sky, and just having your music, you know, the sound waves are just going out and there's nothing to stop them. There's nothing to rebound off. They're just...
I mean, it's horrible for a sound man because at the mercy of wind, of anything else, of hills. But it's pretty amazing. We did one in Portsmouth recently, or Southsea, I think it was specifically. And it was really weird because the way the stage was, the main stage was set up, was there's a fence on the right as you're looking out, which meant all the crowd couldn't see past that fence, but from the main stage you could, and it was just the sea. So just looking out from the stage, you had a sea of people, and literally a few meters to one side was just the beach and the sea going out as far as you could see. And it was like, this is crazy. I feel like Diplo, you know. We're playing on a beach and it's this, yeah,
there's a few of them, right? Like in Europe, and where's this one in Kubana in Russia? We did. It's exactly like that, and it's just it's just so surreal again, because especially once you've just been playing dingy venues all your life, and then you're out in this like landscape of like utter beauty, and you're ruining it, polluting it with your music. There's something quite nice about that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, let's continue on to. Let's get on to lyrics and political activism. Kind of, I think the two come hand in hand with you in many ways. When did you decide that putting that what you wanted to talk about in your lyrics, essentially, and when you wanted to push the boundaries and, you know, address social issues and things like that? Was that from the start, or did that come after you'd kind of calmed down from that initial hype of, we're in a band, fuck?
Right, yeah. I think it was... There was certainly the sense of not just taking authority as, you know, the final word on things. That was instilled in us very early, just from the quaint local struggles that we had with our council.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Just constantly wanting to shut down gigs, not giving a reason, not understanding that it was a positive thing, getting kids off the street. It was creative. It was communal. And it literally was the cliche of just like sort of aging councillors just not really understanding it and thinking that everyone was just doing drugs and being violent.
One of my favourite quotes has always been, and I've used it in a lyric, has always been, observation, not old age, brings wisdom. And I think that's key. And I think the small town thing has that a lot as well, because you'll have the elders of the town. That makes it sound far more grand, but the older people who are on the councils who won't, you know, who won't understand what the change is and what the current thing is. They'll just think, well, that's not allowed. Whereas sometimes, and young people aren't always right. Half the stuff I believed as a teenager or as even early 20s, it's fucking ridiculous now. I realise I was an idiot and I just had ideas above my station or whatever, but they're also not always wrong and shouldn't be ignored. So exactly that, you should be, it's good to have that in you to question authority and to question or what you're being told, and not to outright just say everything that the grown-ups say is rubbish or they're old, to have that in you to go, right, why should we close it down and why is it an issue? And if you can find arguments that counter that, then that's valid, right? And how do you get that across?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was. I think that's something that stuck with us as well. Just the importance of analysis and perspective, and the sort of a scientific way of thinking. It's kind of that and unity. It's just like the two things that we've always really tried to pummel into people with our lyrics. But I don't think much after that. There wasn't too many sort of moments or events that happened. I mean, that got to silly stages. Like there was a point where we were actually doing quite well, maybe 2006, 2007. We came back to play the Auburn Arena.
Yeah.
Not an arena. It's a panto venue, just Brilliant. Called the Auburn Arena.
Nice.
but it, you know, it's a fair size. It's like 1,000 cap.
Yeah.
And the council, first of all, just pulled the show.
Oh, really?
And then one of the great things was the local press were all on our side. So it was brilliant. And it became a total like us versus them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
United the whole scene. It was great. But at the end, they stipulated that for the show to go on, what did they say first? They said there's no bar. Then we fought that and won that.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, it can go ahead, but we need 6 plain clothed police officers in the crowd.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it's insane. And of course, there was absolutely not one incident of any sort of trouble. Yeah, it was a complete waste of time.
And I bet those 6 officers had a great night.
Yeah, I hope so.
The best night ever.
Moshing their heads off. Yeah.
This one's for you guys. And the bar's open. You're welcome.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was a strange few years. But
that's great, though. And that I guess that roots things nice and early on because I was going to ask... when you started to notice your fan base becoming actively politicised and socially aware. And I guess that from early on, it kind of establishes that of going, right, we're, you know, there's a lot of different issues, but they're willing to make a stand and to be, and unity to be there to go, right, let's not just accept this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that as well as about that time, sort of discovering that hardcore wasn't just a local thing, wasn't just a UK thing.
Yeah, of course.
Discovering sick of it all and refused and just kind of just being really influenced by that. Just like, this music is so passionate, so angry. And it when you find out that some of the bands you've been listening to, there's actually no substance to the lyrics. So they're running around shouting and it, is this just an act then? Are they not actually angry?
I mean, like, that's what's quite interesting, I think, about you guys specifically is you can kind of gently listen to and be a fan and observe your music and not realise how political it is. Mm. But if you do wish to pay attention and delve deeper, I mean, obviously there's tracks which, you know, it's different, that it's so clear and so at the front, but...
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things I think is kind of great in a way, that it's not, it stops it coming across as preachy. I mean, I suffer a lot from points being considered preachy or anything like that. The beauty of the message being so beautifully interwoven with everything is that, you know, you can kind of, and not take it or leave it, but it's not forced down your throat constantly. There's kind of some variation in this. And so was that a conscious thing to kind of go, right, at this point, I want some screaming, but I want the screaming to be about something more than just,
just want it to be genuine and be honest. Yeah. And just finding out that bands were just either singing about their own personal relationship, and that to me just felt a bit private and a bit even narcissistic, to do that. And I think probably propelled by the sense of community that we'd sort of grown up in around the local scene and with all the struggles we've had, there was that I often found myself writing we instead of I.
And
just wanting to sort of not speak for people, but you know, just speak about things that affected all of us and not just personal.
Again, I mean that seems to just hark of the old ska and punk unity kind of a vibe and idea of saying that we're all, you know, I'm not claiming to be a spokesperson, but I know there are others that think about this, and I know that the change can only be made with all of us. You know, you as an individual can't overthrow St Albans Council, but you know, as everything that's there, as the demand and as the people, it can be, you know, overturned and taken in. What on your latest record, what subjects kind of came to the forefront? I think it was the first single was a brilliantly kind of attacking of the current, the medical industry and you know, the pharmaceuticals, kind of the way that's all set up. What I don't know, what fights are you currently fighting through the music, and what made you choose these kind of particular things?
Well, I mean, healthcare, I think, because of the current climate in the UK of privatisation, that we wanted to address that, but also on a more global scale, because there's been a lot of points where we've been touring America and the shows are a bit smaller out there, so we can actually hang out on our merch and meet a lot more people. And just realising that, like, there's so many people who literally have to set up, like, a charity for themselves because they need an operation. And it's
crazy out there, right?
Horrific stories, yeah, about people, you know, just come down with cancer and they can't afford, you know, the treatment they need. And it's, yeah, it's just quite, it's really harrowing. And I think it's just a topic that we felt was really, now was the time to approach that properly.
Yeah, completely. And it's scary how so much of a wide society, in many ways, certainly Western society, tends to go the way of America in the end. And the fact that on the healthcare front, that's petrifying out there. That's genuinely a scary situation that, yeah, you could get ill and be told, we've got everything to make you better here, but you can't have it because you've not got the right healthcare, or you've not got the money and things like that. It's just, that's just there.
Yeah.
It'll go out of date in all likelihood. we'll probably end up binning that. Yeah, that's kind of a petrifying thing, right?
Yeah, I remember as well, actually, the first protest that I ever went on was as a... not my parents aren't, like, overtly political really at all, but our local hospital, St Albans, got shut down or really diminished in size. And I remember, you know, doing my own little billboard thing to hold up, sign, like colouring it in, and just like, so yeah, we just went on a protest to that and marched around St Albans. And of course, at the time, I didn't really know, I was maybe 10 or something, I didn't really know why this was happening, but it just seemed so strange. Like, so hold on, there's all these people that work there who are now not going to have a job. There's all this equipment that is now, I don't know what, being sold or dumped probably.
Yeah.
And all these people who need those services are going to have to now travel a lot further, which is quite dangerous in itself.
Yeah, of course.
And it just made no sense. And it's obviously only sort of growing up and then learning about privatisation and right-wing politics in general. Yeah, it just all became like, oh, okay. So it literally is as simple as putting profit before people.
Yeah.
And it often is. It's often portrayed as a much more complicated, you know, nuanced thing. But a lot of the time I seem to find myself siding with that sort of, I guess the sort of John Lennon, you know, peace, man. Yeah, like, literally, sometimes things are really that simple.
Yeah. And what do you feel are the kind of solutions in many ways then? Obviously, just speaking of peace there, but then equally speaking of protests and speaking of marching, what do you feel? I know you've been involved in a lot of different protests and marches and stuff like that. Do you feel in this country marching and protesting is an effective way of getting a message across? Again, I'm not saying either way, curious to see what you think. Do you think, a mindset I've lent to a lot over the years is that in this country, protests are almost there to let us angry people get it all out of our system, and in a way control us all the more.
Right.
You know, if you go here on this date, you've got a 6-hour time in which you can have your say, and then you can go home and say, I went on a march against that.
Right, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But nothing more. Like, how do you feel about that? What's your kind of feeling? Do you think it's important to at least have your say, or do you think that the opportunity to have your say, but it not necessarily have an impact, kind of sedates you a bit from being angry about stuff when there's a lot to be angry about?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So it's like, you know, almost going to the protest, patting yourself on the back, coming home, and exactly. You know, I've done my bit.
I mean, that's it's where I've kind of gone against our current form of democracy a lot, because I think it's in a way it's a comfortable way for those in power to make us, to give us the illusion that we're having a say and having an impact. It's saying, well, next month you can all have your vote, and then after that, you know. Like in the last election where it didn't go the way anyone wanted, it wasn't agreed, this combining of parties and all sorts of other things. Yeah. Yet all we could do is, well, you know, in 4 years' time, we are going to, oh, I'm going to vote again. It's like, cool, you did that this time and it didn't work. It's, and it's kind of, for me, our current form of democracy feels exactly like that. It's that, to give you that chance to say that you're doing something when really they're sitting there going, they think they've got a say in this.
I mean, the whole thing is incredibly demeaning, really. Yeah. It's like, yeah, like you say, trot Mary along to the voting booth every 4 years, and then what else can you do? Well, you can go in the street and you can shout and walk about, I mean, the protest, basically.
Yeah.
And that's your options. I mean, it's incredibly insulting.
And only at the time that we've sanctioned you to do that. You have to ask us first if it's not going to cause too much trouble to protest against us, which I don't know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, the ancient Athenians would laugh at what we call democracy. Yeah. You know, they
completely.
They're.
But then to counter that, obviously, it feels like I'm kind of shitting on all forms of protest and everything. To counter that, it's great that we're at a point where so many people are politicised, even if it is purely through sharing a Facebook post or going on a march. You know, it's a good thing as well that there's more. There seems to be more awareness. Potentially, that's because we're getting in a worse and worse situation, and people have to become more politically aware. But is that something that you've noticed as your career has gone on, that more people at your shows are talking to you either online or afterwards about serious shit, rather than just like, dude, that laser was awesome or anything like that? Is that something that's coming across more?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the stage where people used to just talk about the band and the music, but it really is 50-50 or if not even more weighed.
It's great.
To the fact. I mean, people want to, if they're a fan, they want to say how much they enjoy the music, but I think it's often more interesting for them to say, oh, so what did you mean by this? And should I do this or should I do
discuss
that?
Discuss the topics.
Yeah, obviously.
For me, hearing Billy Bragg talk about you guys instantly made me go, damn, it's definitely made that crossover to being as much about the calls as about, you know, anything else, which is a great thing, surely, I'd say.
Yeah, and it's incredibly motivating as well, because, I mean, there's a lot of times you can be on tour and, you know, you haven't seen your family and your girlfriend and haven't been home for months, and you can be having a few crappy shows, you're completely sleep deprived. You don't feel healthy whatsoever. And there's a lot of points where you can think, if I didn't think I was connecting with like people, and if I didn't have people coming up to me at the merch going, oh, you influenced me to do this, or you helped me through that, or just the fact that our music emboldened their opinions and their views and sort of strengthened them. If there wasn't that side to our music, I don't think I could do it, because I'm not that much of an outgoing person. I'm not sort of extroverted. I like being at home with my friends and my cat, you know, and reading a book. So.
Completely.
So I think there has to be that extra motivation.
That's wicked.
Yeah, just to spur us on.
Yeah. I mean, we're just over the hour mark now, so we'll start to wrap things up. But I wanted to talk to you about the actual release of your last record, A Minesweep, was it? Is that the name? I'm terribly getting names right. Minesweep, I think the music industry is in a real tough place, as everyone knows at the moment, and releasing albums even is a weird and tough thing. It's becoming a more and more alien, as the more the more I think about it in the current industry, the more I think, is the album still a valid thing? I hope it is, but I question it a lot. And one of the things I loved was the pop-up shop that you guys did. I thought that was fucking genius. Can you tell people a bit about that and how it worked and how it went? I remember seeing you guys posting about it and thinking, that's fucking great. Because one of the things that always gets talked about and one of the things I love doing on tours is being at the merch booth and meeting people and being there to engage and the discuss stuff. And again, quite commercially, to make money, to earn that, to sell that. That's still a valid part of what we do and how we keep doing this as our careers. Mm. And yeah, I'd never thought of that. And I loved the idea. If you did a pop-up shop in Camden and was like, right, on the release day, come buy the record from us and we're in the shop. How did that go? And how did that idea even come about?
It was so enjoyable. It was a hectic day. Like, we thought we'd get there. I think we opened at 10 and we thought maybe there'd be a few people there coming before work. Or
scary, right? Isn't it? The fact that you're putting this big thing on and then it might be... no one really turns up.
Well,
no one,
that's we
stuff like that does happen when you're expecting, wow, we've just sold out this huge venue, we're gonna have that. And sometimes people are like, nah, I'm not gonna drop
by. Well, no, we kind of expected to just be like twiddling our thumbs until lunchtime, people on lunch breaks coming out from school and work. And but it was just all day. Like, there was a massive queue when we opened. Yeah, it was just hectic. It was crazy. And it was so much fun. We put up a little... basically, there's a load of photographers that we've worked with and we've loved for ages, and we used a load of their work and sort of blew that up and framed it. So it was a bit of like an arch, you know.
That's amazing,
as well. Had the album and a load of merch and just chatting to people. Yeah, it was brilliant.
Did you have to have the album playing on loop the whole time?
No.
I love, like, you must have done loads of Banquet records. I love the guys at Banquet, but that's always been the awkward thing at signings when it's then a new record play and you're sitting like, and that's normally for like an hour of signing stuff rather than a whole day of.
We did the week of signings on the release week.
Yeah.
So we did about two a day, like, you know, sort of Southampton and Bristol and then Manchester, Liverpool and. Yeah, it was...
I'm on loop.
Every time we get there, we're just like, first thing, can you turn that off, please? Put something, anything else on, like, literally. But.
But yeah, so that was... How long was the pop-up shop? It was purely on release day, right? It was on the day of release and it was just...
Yeah, just a full day. Slugging behind a counter,
Just, again, I think that's a beautiful... a way of doing things and having that engagement with fans and making it a different thing from the tour that is going to happen to promote the album and all the other things that come with it. I thought that was really, I liked it a lot. It's a good idea. So we'll start to round up with what's ahead and where can people kind of keep up to date? Obviously it's tough with you guys because there's Enter Shikari Twitter, there's your own Twitter, everyone's kind of got their own. What's the best way? I mean, we can throw everyone else under a bus here and only give yours if you want, you know, fuck those guys, but
I certainly use I'm addicted to social media more than the other chaps. I think, but I mean, I'm just Raoul Reynolds on Twitter, and then there's the Enter Shikari one as well, and then Instagram,
everything else.
We started Snapchat the other day.
I've not done that yet. Are you enjoying that?
Well, I was totally against it. Well, not against it, but indifferent. And Rory started it up, and it's actually going really well, and the fans seem to love it. Like, I think because it's so throwaway, like the fact that the videos vanish after 24 hours, you can just. There's no pressure, because even on an Instagram video, I feel like, oh, this has to look good or be funny or do something interesting. But on this, you just, you know, take a video and that's it. And sometimes that can actually bring out funnier stuff because you just don't care.
Is there anything that you've been annoyed that it was only there for 24 hours? They've been like, that was fucking gold, man. That should have... we need to reshoot that for Instagram.
That happens so much. Something funny will happen backstage and I'll be like, oh, quick, get the camera. We're behind on our vlogs. We need to do a video diary. And then we try and like redo it and it's just like loses all the
reenact
natural,
and recreate the wonder of it. Works. How do you find social media? Again, I've some people love it, some hate it. I think particularly when you're having political and social stuff as well as your general messing about and nonsense, I find it's a great way to keep that interaction and connection. Are you a fan of it in that way for what you can get across and how it can give a greater, you know, for better or worse, a greater insight into who you are as a person rather than just these 12 songs of opinions on a record?
Mm. Yeah, there's something that always frustrates me is the fact that we never get sort of accused, not really the right word, but accused of being like a serious band or, you know, too serious, but people could listen to the music and probably maybe sort of not quite capture the nuanced, like, comic or ironic bits, here and there. So I think that's one good thing that social media is good for, just to bringing out the sort of silliness that everyone has and just, again, taking down the boundaries between the sort of entertainer and the audience. And we're we're all just normal dudes, you know, like we're just as silly and stupid as everyone else. And I think that's also something important because a lot of people think that, you know, wanting a fighting for a better world and activism should be this sort of stern-faced thing when I don't think that really gets you anywhere. No, like a lack of humour is not a good thing.
It's switched. Are you off? I find the reason that when I post about anything political or social or activism based, the reason it gets a lot of engagement is it's not every day and constant. Half the time I'm just talking absolute shit. So it's kind of, you know, it has that impact. It has a greater impact because 1 minute it's a tweet that's a fart joke and 1 minute it's, look, this is some serious stuff. I almost said shit, but I would have felt too bad after a fart joke line. So this is just, it's kind of, I think it adds to the impact in that way, if you can be more human and engaging.
Definitely, because I mean, people want to know who you are, you know, really beneath all the media attention and the sort of the little pockets of who you are that they get.
The actual edited and put out a version of who you are. There's no, I mean, Snapchat sounds even scarier in that way, that there's no filter.
It is, especially when Rory's in control of it and we'll just be sitting in the dressing room and he'll come in videoing and we won't look up and he'll ask us a question and we'll reply and then realise he videoed it.
Oh, shit, no.
Oh, that's out there.
Don't put that out there. That's perfect. Well, I think we're at the end there, so thank you very much for inviting me into your home and chatting for an hour. It flies by, doesn't it?
It does.
I do these each time and I always think 60 to 90 minutes, that's kind of long. It's just flown by.
Yeah, it's lovely. Thanks.
So thank you very much and enjoy the American tour. I fully recommend people following, particularly on Instagram, because I think a lot of the photography you get at the live shows and stuff like that is just awesome. So
cool.
I look forward to following you from distance. Thank you very much.
Thanks, dude.
Bye.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Distraction Pieces.
That was episode 27 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Thank you for tuning in. That was good, wasn't it? I love that dude. It was great to see. It's the first time we'd sat down and had a proper chat. So that was good to get through. Not next week, tomorrow. We're doing two this week as well. In fact, before I get on to tomorrow's one, I'd like to give a few... if you enjoyed that, then you might like. We mentioned a Billy Bragg there. So we've had Billy Bragg on the podcast a few weeks ago. And in fact, last week we had Wes Borland on. So he'd be a good one to check out. We got a bit political towards the end there. There's some great podcasts previously with Josie Long, who's a great comedian and activist, with a company called FullFact.org, which is one of my favourite podcasts we've done, because their job is to fact check all the nonsense that people end up sharing on Facebook, from Britain First and people like that, but then also all the stats and nonsense that are quoted in Parliament at times that isn't actually a fact check correctly. So that's a really good one. So check them out. But let's move on to tomorrow. We've got Sarah Pascoe, who is one of my favourite comedians. She's absolutely brilliant. And it was another one where our discussion could have gone on for hours and hours. She's a really good talker, intelligent lady, and just hilarious. I caught her Edinburgh show in 2013, I think, and it blew me away. And she's been winning awards and tearing things up ever since then. So please click subscribe and auto-download if you can. That'd be great. But yeah, we're back tomorrow. See you in a bit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.